Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the media focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Peter, we both had birthdays last week. Does that make this the official birthday cast?
So did the Queen. The Queen had an official birthday as well.
Well, we're in good company then.
Yeah, I love it when they march all those bands up there just for my birthday. Brilliant.
Were the protests anything to do with you guys as well?
There were no protests. Everyone was just lining up to support Trump.
Apparently the Queen had the
48
best
48 seconds
ever.
In. 48 seconds in and we mention him.
So Esther, when's your birthday?
My birthday's in November. And if you want to keep up with all my birthdays and all the birthday announcements and all the news and views from around the media world, we have a newsletter. The episode has not even started, so you can't forget. Go to voices.media to sign up for it.
This week, I spoke to Google's head of news ecosystem development, Madhav Chanapa. He is aware that that is a very Google title. So we sat down for a wide-ranging and brisk tour through everything from why Google's relationship with publishers is probably best characterized as love-hate, whether a search company's priorities can ever truly lie parallel to that of publishers, and what lessons we can take away from the Google News Initiative. Don't forget that we also have put out a Conversations episode that is specifically about memberships and subscriptions. So I sat down with Katie Vanek-Smith of Tortoise and Michael Silverman of Piano, and I've had a couple of people this week actually come up to me and say they really enjoyed it. So please do go to voices.media where you can listen to that very special episode.
Yay!
Before that, though, we're doing the news roundup, and Dutch digital news aggregator Blendl is stopping selling individual news articles for a few cents to focus on its premium subscription service. So, Esther, why don't you take us through what happened?
Well, it's difficult to find out what happened because literally the only place that covered this was like a local Dutch news outlet. And I'm surprised the media haven't picked up on this a lot more. But anyway, so the kind of Spotify for News they launched back in 2014... They collected articles from a variety of newspapers, magazines, and sold them on like a pay-per-article basis. I think the idea was that you like blend all the outlets you want to see. Clever. All the outlets you want to read without having to pay for just one. And then they launched a premium, like basically a Spotify service in 2017, which gave readers articles for €10 a month. A little bit like Readly, I guess, and Apple News Plus. So like Blendl have been ahead of the game for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, they've been going for like 5 years, and they originally was just straight up micropayments, but then they launched this premium service a couple of years ago, and I think that's maybe why it hasn't had the attention, because all they've really done is kind of stepped away from individual article payments and gone full steam ahead on the premium subscription side.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting you say that then, because it has been almost heralded as the latest piece of evidence that micropayments for news do not work.
I've seen so much micropayment snark in Twitter.
Well, it's so easy, but it's also bollocks.
Well, okay, so before the podcast, I asked both of you to write down your take on what is happening with micropayments for news. Yeah, I gave you homework. So in 200 words, Esther, I think you overachieved on that one. I've used textfixer.com to generate some random choices, so I'm going to now press random choice, and it'll decide which of us is going to speak first. So, me.
Oh. All right. Fuck off.
Okay. So, on micropayments, I wrote, the failure of these high-profile schemes is not proof that micropayments will never work for news, just that their time has not come yet. Paying for items digitally, whether through Amazon or any number of payment methods, has tended to disincentivize small purchases. And the bleed over from that, I believe, is still affecting how consumers approach micropayments. Possibly schemes like Agate's digital wallet-based approach will remedy that, but possibly not. Additionally, as with publishers having yet to figure out best practice for acquisition when it comes to subscriptions, so too is more experimentation around the best model for micropayments required. Whether the future of micropayments looks like a tip jar, a downloadable content-like model, or something else entirely is still to be determined. And then I still had about 40 words left of my 200-word limit, so I just wrote, go fuck yourself, George Osborne, about 60 times. So I'm now going to press the button again and see who's up next.
It's not allowed to be you again, by the way. You do know that.
Esther, you're up.
Okay.
Oh, this is a fix.
Wait, you get to go last. Recency effect. Yours will stay in people's minds.
Oh, true.
Okay, so I'm a bit conflicted because I think that there is a place for micropayments in the publishing ecosystem. but they're not going to save publishing. But I think that there is hope for them as part of a revenue strategy, and that, like Chris, I don't think anybody really in the West has cracked it yet. So I think that there's got to be a way we can monetize some more of the like 95% of people who won't ever subscribe to a publication. An example I like to give is that I wouldn't subscribe to Wired US because I'm in the UK, but I would love to be able to like tip or donate to them for their amazing Facebook exposés, because I'm a massive fan of that kind of stuff. Same with the New York Times. It does some great media analysis, but it doesn't really write enough relevant content for me to want to pay each month for them. I think if you look at models like Twitch, casual tipping has been hugely successful, and The Guardian is I mean, arguably it's not micropayments, but they've gone down a line of donations for things that you can otherwise access. You're about halfway through now, guys. Congratulations.
Okay.
So I think for me, I don't necessarily think the idea of paying 50p for an article will ever really catch on over here. Partly because I just don't think like the faff of ever setting up the payment will be worth it, no matter how smooth that system gets. But if all the publishers who are setting up paywalls were more flexible with them and did like day, week passes for a couple of quid, I think we're verging on micropayment territory that could be successful in making money from drive-by readers. And then my final note is just given the increasing globalization of media audiences, I think this sort of model is inevitable once paywall fatigue kicks in, something between micropayments and subscriptions. I have a PS. Do you want to hear it? If you don't think micropayments will ever happen, hello media Twitter snark people, look at how WeChat has enabled tipping for creators and publishers in Asia, and we're actually really behind on this in the West.
Yeah, didn't they build that like back in 2015?
Yep.
That's insane that it hasn't really been over here.
It's the equivalent of Facebook doing like donations to the articles you see in your newsfeed. Don't get any ideas, Facebook.
Okay, so I'm just now going to press this button again just to see who... Peter, do you want to take us through micropayments?
I do. I'll join Esther in saying I think paywall fatigue is absolutely the key in this.
Mm.
Because as competition grows for subscription dollars, falling retention rates for more established players and slow take-up for newer players is almost inevitable, I reckon. And a slowdown in digital subscription growth, because it's been mental for the past couple of years. I don't think that's going to keep going. The slowdown in digital subscription growth will lead to the development of a more mixed payment ecosystem, with publishers trying to monetize the audience relationships that they have established, either free or lapsed subscribers or whatever. And in that sense, I can see individuals having one or two cherry subscriptions that they just keep paying for in either news or niche interests. Maybe an all-you-can-eat deal like Readly that gives them access to a broad range of content. Possibly taking up time-limited passes. So I'll buy something for a fortnight because I'm going on holiday, or a day because I need to do research or whatever, or I'm traveling. The one aspect of this which is absolutely missing for me is still that micropayment thing, because that's where you've got the real choice, where you can facilitate what Esther described, that low value impulse buy, or not necessarily an impulse buy, just a very specific interest that you have. And the problem, as Esther said, is that the tech's too clunky at the minute. But I don't agree. I think it will get solved. It will get sorted. The technology will develop to the point with what Thomas Bechdahl called recently a short transaction cycle, and following that old kind of web design principle of don't make me think, then I think we've got a proper content payment ecosystem, from full on loyalty from subs all the way through to individual article buys. Boom!
The one thing I'd say I think that we have in common is that the tech is behind, and the problem we have in our country is that the tech, literally, unless somebody like Facebook introduces something like this, which we don't want them to do, it doesn't stand a chance. The reason it's working in China is because everybody's on WeChat, and WeChat is a payment system for everything.
But what is someone like Agate or Agate? I don't know how you pronounce that.
But whatever it is, it's got to get to the stage where enough people are using it and enough publishers are using it to make it worth it. And I mean, we're a long way off that.
And Esther, you mentioned Twitch there, where obviously people have been sort of tipping, whether that's through bits or, you know, donating, you know, £5 or whatever to streamers. But the implication I've seen from, you know, people around this Blendle thing is that it's not going to work for news, that news as a commodity is not something that people are willing to pay, you know, 79p or whatever to access a single article for.
The thing that that blew my mind about Twitch when my husband showed me is that all this stuff was open, and you think, yeah, okay, you know, if you had to pay for access, whatever, but all this stuff was open and people were just tipping. And then when you actually think about it, tipping, like, and yeah, I know the word tipping might not be your favourite, but it's something that...
terminology.
But we're so used to it as a culture, you know, we tip our waiters, we tip our taxi drivers.
That's bullshit. I'm a fucking professional journalist. I've spent 5 weeks researching a piece of content, and you're going to tip me for it? Piss off.
But this will always come down to the question of, is that tip more worth more money than that one person visiting the ad impression and the money you get from that?
Yeah, I'm arguing with the terminology, not the economics.
You know, having it is that mix of revenue is one way of getting around the idea that, you know, you either subscribe or you don't. And if you don't, then we're not going to try and monetize you. You know, as ads become sort of more, well, a smaller share of publishers' priorities, let's put it that way. Monetizing the unmonetizable this way, having a system where, you know, even the odd person can throw a couple of quid at you, seems exactly, it needs to be part of that mix.
But it's worked for The Guardian. This is the thing, is that The Guardian's not 50p. The Guardian suggests the minimum donation of a fiver. But they've just made their business profitable on the back of that.
Why did this not work for Blendle? What made its founder, Alexander Klopping, say, we have 60,000 subscribers and 100,000 people who pay per article, but I have to be honest, we are still not making a profit?
There's a really, really simple answer to this, and that is that micropayments aren't going to make journalism sustainable, let alone the people that enable that journalism.
Yeah, it's incidental revenue.
Publishers will use it as a supplement, not as their business model, and that's where things like Blendle, like they're never going to make the money back from that.
I also think when they introduced that premium service in 2017, they changed their own narrative.
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of mixed message there that you can buy individual articles, but you're actually still subscribing. I think it's a technology thing. If I knew how to pay, I think, you know, what it used to be for a song on iTunes, 79 pence.
Yeah.
If I knew that I could read a 4,000 word article that I can't currently read for 79 pence, I'd pay it, if there was an easy way of doing that.
Well, you're right, because I would pay it for long-form stuff. I'm not sure that I would necessarily... Like, say Washington Post, they do, you know, some huge expose or whatever. I don't currently subscribe. I've hit that paywall. If they said, but pay per access to read this one thing that we're going to, you know, add to our, you know, dedicated micropayment block of articles that we think people will do it for, then I absolutely would.
No, to Esther's point on the New York Times, I'm currently subscribed to the New York Times. Cost me $8.50 a month. It's not worth it because I don't read enough.
Mm.
But if I could spend, you know, I don't know, whatever that would be, £3 that, like, over the course of 5 articles, yeah. And once Facebook's set up its bank, we'll all be sorted.
Face coins. Paying for everything with face coins.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
It's whether it'll work for publishers.
Yeah. It could work for long-form features or niche features.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nobody's throwing in, like, a couple of quid to read whatever garbage the sun's tossed off this week. Well, yeah, let's move on then. So the Sun publisher is facing major job cuts. Staff, basically huge swaths of staff, have been invited to apply for voluntary redundancy, and about a quarter of the cuts are expected to come from the online operation. Peter, what are they sort of attributing these necessary cuts to?
They've not got enough money.
Okay.
they've had, like, their pre-tax losses in 2018 have tripled.
Mm.
Sales are down, like, what, 8-9% for the Daily and the Sunday.
Well, that was 8-9%, not 89%.
Yeah, they're just struggling like a bunch of newspaper publishers are struggling. It sounds like we're enjoying this, and that's...
No, we're not, no.
That's people's job.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's nice when anything that takes money away from the family is always nice, but...
They won't be the ones who bear the brunt of this.
Yeah, exactly.
So last weekend I was up at the World News Media Congress in Glasgow, and I heard from David Dinsmore, you know, he gave everyone a talk about kind of the Sun and how a lot of their print stuff is actually enabling them to do some really good stuff with digital and sort of all about Sun Rewards. But clearly it's the digital operation just doesn't work for them.
Maybe they should try a paywall. But, no way.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. That's exactly it. It's proof that they have a real problem. The Sun has an enormous problem when it comes to monetizing itself digitally.
But how come the Mail doesn't have a problem? They grew their revenues. There's a conversation stopper for you. We should throw this out to the audience and ask them if they've got an opinion.
Yeah, tweet us. Tweet us at Media Voices Pod. A couple of something struck me when I saw the news about that, and I went back and I found that interview that Tony Gallagher did, talking about how he wants to hire people fresh out of school, which
I bet he does.
Yeah, exactly. Which, in light of this news, he was saying he wants to hire people direct out of school, pay them peanuts, throw them down into the journalism mines, and just burn them out.
Haven't they been doing that for years?
They have, but now they want to do it to school kids. Well, Peter, you just mentioned the Mail there. But there's some news about the Mail Online and some terrible news for the Mail Online. So, Esther, why don't you take us through what's kind of hitting the Mail Online this week?
Yeah, this is literally every audience development employee's nightmare. The Mail Online, which, as I think we mentioned, it was it last week that they grew their online revenues by a quarter. They've just seen their traffic from search halve this week after Google's algorithm update.
Yeah.
So for anybody that doesn't work in a publisher, Google makes algorithm changes like quite frequently, like every couple of
months. If you don't work in a publisher, why the fuck are you listening to this podcast?
For the repartee.
But anyway, so Google quite frequently makes algorithm updates that can see publisher traffic fluctuate. You know, like 30% will give people heart attacks for a week. 50% is bad. They also don't ever give a reason for why things might fall foul of the algorithm updates, so that they're really, really opaque about what they've changed and what the impact will be. But I think this problem came to light early this week because the Mail Online's SEO director,
Jesus Mendez.
Okay, whatever Peter said. He posted in a Google support forum about the 50% drop in search traffic from the algo update on June the 3rd. Makes me sweat thinking about this.
Have we seen anyone else complaining about that kind of drop?
No, other publishers have gone up. they were saying, I think the
that's the fucking worst thing.
We're not a snarky podcast.
A Mail Online spokesperson said the update had an impact, but only on our non-brand search. They added, "We have been working with Google to figure out what is going on, but the people we are speaking to there are as baffled as we are."
That's honestly, like they make these changes and do not release any of the reasons why they've made the change.
Yeah, they don't release patch notes. That's very.
But I think.
Doesn't it sound like someone's just kicked a plug out?
The really interesting thing here is that the drop in the search traffic has been really pronounced for the UK audience. So normally when algo changes happen, it's usual to see a drop off in global audience for UK or particularly geo-specific sites. So they're all kind of scratching their heads over there. But revenue hasn't been impacted, which is another weird one.
Well, because so much of their traffic is direct and from apps, because it's old people that have got it bookmarked or on the iPad that their son bought them for Christmas.
So talking of transcripts and trying to transcribe everything, we've got a growing transcript section on our website thanks to a clever AI transcription tool from Trint. You can see them all on voices.media/transcripts. And there is also a link to our dedicated email list that sends the transcript out every Monday.
How many times could you squeeze the word transcript in one paragraph? That's brilliant!
So this week I spoke to Manav Chinappa, who is the head of news ecosystem development at Google. We had a fairly brisk and wide-ranging chat about everything from the contentious relationship between publishers and platforms to what lessons they've taken away from the Google News Initiative and sort of future plans around that. But I began by asking him, what is the purview of his role given that very Google job title? Director of News Ecosystem Development. You must be the only one in the world with that job title, maybe?
I suspect I might be, but we do a very good line of kind of ridiculous titles at Google. So,
I didn't want to say that, but yeah, I was going to say it's a very Google job title.
Yeah. What it is really trying to look at all the things that we do with the news ecosystem overall and represent the ecosystem and work with the ecosystem. Beginning of last year, we launched something called the Google News Initiative. Which was really our big focus to try to help journalism thrive in the digital age It had been based on a previous thing that we'd done in Europe, which was called DNI, the Digital News Initiative. And my current role is really to work on the innovation side, but also the dialogue between publishers, the news ecosystem, and Google on the product side as well, to see how we can all collaborate. A lot of what I do is trying to bring people together to create that environment where good things can happen. What we did in each of those areas is to think, what is Google's role in this area? What's the actual problem that we're trying to solve, and how do we help build helpful products for both publishers and for users? And when we looked at the mobile space, what was being said at the time, and it's funny to think about this because it was 4 years ago, but at the time everyone's going, well, yeah, everyone's moving to mobile. Mobile is so complicated, and then we've got all these tech companies coming to us and asking for our content, whether it's, you know, Apple with Apple News at the time, not Apple News Plus as it is now.
God, it's so confusing. All these reiterations of names and everything.
Yeah, they had Apple News at that time. They were saying they had, you know, it was instant articles. Mm. You had Snapchat Discover. You even, at the time, you had Google Play Newsstand.
Mm.
And they were saying the problem was that all these tech companies were coming and saying, you know, hey, give us a feed of your content, all different tech feeds, all different tech requirements, and we'll host them for you and do different things. Can you help simplify this?
Mm.
And then when the engineers in Mountain View looked at this issue, they said, well, why is this happening? And what they realized was that essentially this was happening because the mobile web was too slow.
Mm.
And when they realized that was the actual heart of the problem, they realized this is not a problem Google can solve, right? This is an ecosystem issue. And that's how AMP, Accelerated Mobile Pages, was developed as an open source form of HTML that is really keeps publishers in control and is optimized for mobile speed. And you know, when we brought it back to that group, they were a little surprised, actually. Mm. They said, oh, we thought you'd come up with your version of instant articles. And you know, the engineer quite rightly said, well, that wouldn't have solved your problem. And I really liked that because it showed that when you have this dialogue about the challenges, you may get to good solutions, which you may not have thought about in the first place. Mm. In the time that I've been at Google, Google has improved in that dialogue. But let's be clear, in the beginning stages, it was not very good at that at all. At all. And I think we've got better. I think we've got a ways to go. But I do believe that dialogue and that collaborative approach is the way to get to help with the sustainability, the news ecosystem that we all love.
So what then is almost the ultimate goal of your role here? Is it to continue to support, or is it to find sort of to give them the tools to solve their own issues?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, right? I think, you know, our commitment to the news ecosystem has been, you know, from a Google perspective, has been going on for over 15 years. Mm. I've only been at Google for about 8 years now, and I should have confessed in the very beginning. I'm a news person. Yeah. I started Associated Press Television. I was on the startup team for that. I went to the BBC, and let me be crystal clear, I'm like the technically dumbest person at Google. but I really am the news person, and I think there are many more news voices at Google, which has helped with that overall dialogue that we're trying to do. And you know, I think it's important to understand why Google cares.
Mm.
Right? And the way that I describe it is that we care really for sort of three reasons. One is around our mission. Second's around our products, and third, quite pragmatically, is around our business model, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, in the mission, you know, our mission about making the world's information accessible and useful, news is an important part of that. And, you know, we think that an informed public makes for better civil society. I know that sounds really cheesy, and so that's my words, not official Google words, but I think that, you know, that's that news is important. And I think when you talk to any news person, they kind of get a bit shy about saying why news is important, but you kind of dig beneath the surface and they'll say to you that news is important, right?
Yeah.
And we share that same value, which I think is very, very important. But also we have a series of products that that work with publishers. And you know, we have products that send publishers traffic, obviously search and Google News. But we also have products that are in our ad tech space that we work with publishers a lot. And that comes to the final point around our business model,
mm.
right? And the way that we interact with the news ecosystem is very much around a revenue share model, right? And in this space, in the space that we operate in, the space that's relevant in digital advertising to publishers, we only make money when publishers make money because we're an ad tech supplier. That's different from the other tech companies, but that's, you know, it's important to understand, I think, our role in that. And so therefore we're sort of selfishly incentivized to want the news ecosystem to thrive, because if they thrive and they make more money, we end up making more money as well.
It seems that that would be the case, you know, not just for publishers. Whoever is, you know, doing really well will drive growth in ad spend. So there might be a disconnect there between what's important to, you know, not just you personally, did a really good job explaining why news is important to you. What is important from a kind of personal level or on a kind of social level doesn't necessarily translate to what is important to Google from a business perspective, because surely any growth in ad spend then would be beneficial. It doesn't necessarily have to come from publishers.
Well, there's a significant chunk of our business that is all tied to publishers, right? And you know, I must confess, like I said, I was a BBC and AP, so I'm not an ads person. I actually had to understand and learn Google's ad business. So this
how long did that take?
A lot of Googling. But you know, this is very much a layman's view on that. But if you look at Google's business, I think this is important to understand Google's business, right? The vast majority of Google's income comes from search advertising. That's when you type in, like I did over the weekend, you know, a car rental in Toronto because I'm going on holiday in the summer, and you see ads. And you know, those ads are paid for by advertisers based on the clicks that people click through, and that is not a piece of business that publishers are in. That's performance-driven advertising. Publishers are in the display advertising business. And in the display advertising business, Google is an ad tech supplier, right? And we provide tools that publishers can use to kind of source ads or serve ads. And we do that on a revenue share model. And our revenue shares start at 70% and go up, depending on how you use that. So again, if you look at the display advertising business for publishers in that space as a supplier, we only make money when publishers make money. So that's why we're always trying to, you know, help them thrive in that space.
Absolutely. And so you came to our 100th episode. Yeah. And afterwards, you sort of, we were having a chat and you said there was a misconception about where, you know, this idea that growth in ad spend is primarily going to Google and Facebook. I just wondered if you could maybe elaborate on that, because it does seem to be a preconception that is very widespread, particularly among publishers.
Yeah. And you know, I think that you have to kind of, and again, I'm saying this as a layperson, you know, when I heard some of these memes that were out there, I actually went in and tried to do some research and asked smarter people than me about how that worked. And I think if you look at things like the e-marketer data about the different type of digital advertising, what you see there is both search and display are growing. And actually, display was growing faster than search in Europe in the reports that I looked at. And then when you look at display, which is the relevant part, that's the piece where we're a supplier. We are not a competitor. So the way that it was explained to me was, imagine you're an advertiser, right? And you have a pound to spend. You can put a pound into a publisher. And if we are a supplier, we'll take a little piece of that, but the vast majority of that will go to the publisher. If you put it into the Google Display Network, again, we'll take a piece of that, but the vast majority will go to where that ad ends up being displayed on the publisher side. That's different from some of the other tech companies that are out there, right? We don't see ourselves in digital display as a competitor.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Then when do you think that misconception, these memes came from?
I think the reality is that it is very tough in the news ecosystem right now. There's
Nobody would ever argue with that.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And I think that what that has done is sometimes people are looking for sort of both easy people to blame and easy solutions.
Yep.
Right? So it's very easy to blame technology or Facebook and Google or the duopoly and all phrases like that. But I think the reality is that it's actually very complicated and nuanced. And so I think if we're going to have a successful, sustainable, thriving news ecosystem, we actually need to diagnose what's going on very specifically and understand that, you know, these are the different roles that people play in this ecosystem. And that's why I keep using the word ecosystem, right? And that's why it's in my title. But, you know, I remember when I first started in this at Google, I in some public speech, I used the word ecosystem, and the moderator laughed at me. He was like, oh, you know, buzzword bingo. And I said, well, the reason that I use it, and please tell me if you got a better word, but the reason that I use it in an ecosystem, all the parts of that ecosystem interact with each other in different ways. And so there's dependencies, there's links, and the health of the overall ecosystem is based on the different parts. And what I found really interesting is that, you know, Sundar, our CEO, said a while back, he goes, you know, we consider ourselves an ecosystem company. Now, he's going to put it much more eloquently than I will. So, you know, please feel free to Google or Bing exactly what he said. But essentially what he was saying is that if you look at, you know, some of our businesses, like, you know, like our ad tech business, as I said, but also things like YouTube, things like Play, they're all built on revenue shares because we're part of that ecosystem. As the ecosystem grows and thrives, because of that revenue share basis, we will grow and thrive. So we need to balance the issues with the ecosystem as well as the issues with the users.
Yeah. I think there's something that we'll all agree on, that, you know, every member of the Media Voices team will agree on, is that publishers do love an easy target for blame when it comes to this kind of thing. You know, if you look at the kind of the pillaring that Craigslist is still getting in a lot of cases. But at the same time, it does feel like there is that publishers and Google fundamentally have different priorities in a lot of cases. And what's right for publishers might not necessarily be right for Google. So just today I saw an article on What's New in Publishing about tracking, which Google's made some changes in line with what its users prioritize or what you actually want to protect your users. But publishers are now having to scramble to respond to that. So is there ever a case where people will all be pulling in the same direction, or is it finding a compromise?
So actually, I think we have a lot more in common and we share a lot more together. And let's talk about the tracking, because I think, again, the devil is very much in the detail there. I don't think anyone would say that it's a bad thing for users to have more control over their data, right? And that's actually what they've been trying to do in Chrome. But they're trying to do it in a very balanced way. If you look at what we said in terms of the approach that we're using there, we have flagged things coming saying, we're going to do this in the future, so please think about how you do that. We're trying to make it transparent to the user, but we're also trying to make it transparent to the publisher. So, you know, again, the devil is very much the detail there. And we think we're doing that in that balanced way between the user and the ecosystem. And it's in a way, it's similar to some of the stuff that we've done around the work that we've done around ad blocking, right? And again, that was one of the things that was brought up by the D&I working group back in the day, where they said, again, 3-4 years ago, ad blocking, oh my God, right? You know? What can you do? Again, Google looked at this and said, right, this is an issue. And what they did is that they actually said, we can't solve this on our own. They brought a bunch of people together. They created the Coalition for Better Advertising. And then what they did is they went and did user research, right? And they tried to make it user-oriented. So they went to try to find out why people were ad blocking. And, you know, in a lot of the cases, it was because the ads were terrible experiences, right? Yeah. There was also a chunk of people who didn't realize they had ad blockers because somebody else had put it on, which I always found that amusing. But
oh my God, they must have, that's a completely different internet. You turn that off and show them what it's actually like. Yeah. They go, what the hell is this?
But then when you dug deep into the research and said, okay, well, then you started showing people different types of ad formats, what they realized is actually people didn't mind ads. They minded really intrusive ads. And actually, when you also educated them about the fact that, hey, do you know what? The ads subsidize the content that you're enjoying. People were even more open to it, right? And that's why we put in tools and solutions to help with that. And that's why, as an industry, we came together and say, you know what? This is where the user research really says that the line is. And we should really be, as an industry, better about that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really strong movement. And so, you know, and I think I see the kind of the ad tracking stuff in the browsers as a natural outgrowth of that. You know, people understand that, but users should have transparency and control over that. And publishers should be able to understand that as well. And so this narrative that sometimes gets built of Google versus publishers and everything that Google does is really horrible for publishers actually doesn't stand up to scrutiny when you actually look at the detail of it, because our incentives are very much aligned, I think.
So that's interesting, particularly in light of what you said about the Coalition for Better Ads, which at the time was mooted in some circles as being, you know, a change that was being forced upon publishers. Sounds like you're saying that was actually in service of
you have better experience for the users, which in turn is better experience for publishers, in turn creates this better environment in which to serve ads.
Agreed, and also came from a problem that was highlighted by publishers, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
Right, so, you know, the publishers highlighted this as an issue. We looked at the problem and said, okay, actually, this is something that needs to be done at the ecosystem systemic level, right? Let's create that framework for doing it. We are a part of it, no doubt about that, but we are one part of it with a group of other people. Because I think what you don't want is, you know, in that situation, you don't want one person saying, this is it, right? Actually, it's better to build a consensus around that, which is what I think they had done through the great work of the teams that worked on the Coalition for Better Advertising.
Mm. You, in addition to kind of the work you've done around D&I and everything, you're also a fellow at the Reuters Institute, the study of journalism.
I'm on the advisory board. I wasn't a fellow.
Ah, okay, all right. So you get to talk to publishers about their priorities, and it seems that lately it's been shifting towards reigniting that direct relationship that they have with their audiences, which in a lot of cases they neglected when they first went into digital. So in your experience, what is best practice then for really reigniting that relationship, and is there anybody who's doing it particularly well?
So I think, and again, I want to be careful that I don't come across as saying, well, you should be doing X, Y, and Z, because I think the smart publishers are the ones who actually understand their own brand identity, understand their audiences, and understand their kind of, you know, what's the marketing phrase, their USP, you know, and what is different and special about them. And then realize, how do you use that to build the relationship? And I think the best examples in the UK are probably going to be the FT and the Guardian, right? Both of whom who've taken an approach for direct to user, but in very different ways, right? You've got the paywall approach of the FT, which is, you know, I think by any measure, phenomenally successful.
Yeah, very happy. So, yeah.
But also one of the things that they've done is they just really are rigorous about it. Right, and they are constantly reevaluating it. They're really, really smart about it. And they're thinking about it all the time, not just as a paywall, but as the overall. You know, what is the value that they give to the user, and how do they track that user is still getting that value? Right. I was listening to the Media Voices podcast you had with Katie Vanek Smith. And I forget the name from Piano.
Michael Silver.
Yes. And again, I think, you know, everything that was said on that podcast, basically don't listen to me, listen to that one, right? I think it is great. But I think it's also interesting that you have The Guardian, who, and again, let's be clear, when they came out with their membership model, you know, they were pilloried.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. I think completely unfairly, absolutely unfairly. And I think they have proved all those naysayers completely wrong, because they understood that there is this connection that people have with The Guardian. I think that's what Katie was talking about in that podcast, about memberships being different from subscriptions, right? There was, you want to be part of something, and they've tapped into that. And this is the amazing power of the internet. You know, so much of their revenue is coming from America, right? And the places that they haven't been in historically.
Yeah. We spoke about display advertising before. You said they are display advertising businesses in lots of ways, but they're now focusing publishers, you know, who have this audience, they think they can monetize this way, they're focusing on subscriptions. So from your experience talking to people, how much of a challenge do you think it's going to be for kind of the smaller to mid-sized publishers to actually do that effectively?
I think, again, I refer you back to the podcast with Katie and Michael, right? Which is, it was really interesting when they were talking about, you need to start with your product strategy first and your audiences, right? And so I think, again, you got to go back and say, what is the thing that you are offering of value to your user? Another way of phrasing that I quite like is to think about, what is the problem you're trying to solve, right? What is the problem that you're trying to solve for your user, your audience, you know, and how do you build a business around that? I think there are other elements that, you know, you need to, you know, obviously from a UX perspective, you need to make it simple and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I was talking with somebody from the Play team a couple of years ago, and they went through the steps on mobile to subscribe for a news organization. There was 26 steps.
It's bizarre,
right?
Isn't it?
And so there's a whole element that you need to solve on the UX side, and we're trying to help with that through Subscribe with Google. But you need to do those first bits first, which is, what is it that you are delivering of value that someone would be willing to pay for? And I thought what was really interesting from there was some Reuters Institute research about people's propensity to pay. Mm. And they said people are willing to pay, but their expectations are very high. You know, their comparison is not new site X versus new site Y. It's Netflix and Spotify, right? And in the US and Hulu. And so, you know, that's the kind of barrier making things really, really simple that you need, but also from a content proposition, what is the value that you're delivering as well?
But you preempted my question there around subscribe with Google. I just wondered what's the sort of the status, how much of that is still in consultation with publishers?
Yeah, and I think we're very much still in the consultation phase. We have around 50 partners across 18 countries who are in different phases of implementation. I think that it's, you know, it's still early days is what we're saying. We've seen some encouraging signs of success. But again, it's really hard to actually measure success because most of the publishers we're working with are existing paywall publishers or subscriptions in some way. So it's about if you're going to say something is a success or not, you actually have to do a like-for-like comparison. And actually doing like-for-like comparisons really quite difficult.
Yeah.
Right? But where we have seen that, and I think there was some Brazilian publishers and some Australian publishers who have been talking about how they have seen their uptake rates through Subscribe with Google being higher than their existing ones. Mm. And we're hoping very soon to be publishing some more case studies where people can kind of drill into that. And I think what I would say is, like I said, it's early days. We're seeing good signs of success. We want to publish these case studies so that individual organizations can go and see, okay, that's similar to mine or that's not similar to mine. So maybe that learning is not completely accessible to me, applicable to me. Or actually that works. Maybe I should think about this in this way. Because I think there's another piece that we're trying to do under GNI in particular, which is around knowledge sharing.
Right? Okay.
And trying to get publishers to share knowledge of their experiences better. And I think that there's this, and I say this as a news guy, right? Which is that, a news person, that news organizations have always been very, very competitive with each other.
They felt like cats.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're constantly at each other's throats.
Yeah, and I think that is a good thing. But I also think there are areas that they don't need to compete.
Mm.
And actually for the health of the overall, insert my buzzword of ecosystem here, that the more that people share, the better that I think we will all be on that. So that's why we'd subscribe with Google. We're asking, you know, the publishers if they're willing to share their learning so people can take learnings from that. But I think, you know, I would say that just because it works for publisher X does not mean it's going to work for publisher Y. Mm. Because again, going back to, you got to understand yourself first.
See, and that it all seems to, for me, to come back to this idea that you look at publishers as one entity, or you look at, you know, the duopoly as one entity, you know, whatever that actually means in practice. And it what works for the goose won't necessarily work for the gander, but people still insist on treating the conversation as though it is a kind of this dichotomy, an either or, a versus situation. Whereas really, it's so much more complex than that.
I completely agree with you. And I think the issues are too important for that kind of conflation and simplicity to be the common currency. I really wish we were having better, deeper conversations about this because those issues are important. And doing those kind of conflations just doesn't help anybody.
What would be the one piece of media in any form that you would recommend to our audience, that engendered kind of an emotional response in you?
Can I pick two?
You can.
Okay, I'll go kind of geeky.
Okay.
And
because the conversation we've had so far has been very mainstream.
But I haven't finished it yet, but I'm really enjoying the book by Hans Rosling called Factfulness. He's a Swedish demographer. Sadly, he passed away recently. And he did some brilliant stuff on BBC Two where he actually is looking at all the rates of improvement in the world, right? And in the beginning of the book, there's this brilliant little quiz that asks you things about, you know, what do you think about child mortality? Has it gone up, down? What do you think about this, that, and the other, right? The world is getting better.
Mm.
I know it doesn't feel like that in a lot of situations, but there are a lot of underlying signs that the world is getting better, and it's very much a data-driven approach to that, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Plus, I'm also reading a book by an ex-colleague called The Lost Letters of William Wolfe, which I'm really enjoying.
And the ex-colleague Madhav was referring to is named Helen Cullen.
So people, we have a newsletter. I'm so tired of telling you guys this. We've got a newsletter. If you go to the website, you'll see a link. Just put your email in and we'll send it to you. It's great.
And literally all the news articles we've talked about and more, we put out on our Twitter feed during the week. So if you follow us at Media Voices Pod, that'll make sure you're even more up to date than you already are after having listened to this.
And as promised, a massive shout out, massive, in this week's episode for the person that tweeted the classic Scottish album title. It was in the newsletter, bandwagon-esque people, Chris Maylard. Well done you, what a guy.
The prize and the Blue Peter badge are winging their way to you in the post. And we also want to give a big shout out to Renata Fernandez, who said, and I'm reading from the tweet, "I've made the podcast intro song my mobile phone ringtone. It brings a smile to my face every time." So that's probably the nicest feedback we've ever had. Just wanted to say thank you very much. And as a treat, I'm going to make the outro music slightly longer this week. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Ta-da!
Bye.